Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Yesterday, Iowa banned access to abortion at 6 weeks, which is before most women, girls, and people who can become pregnant know that they are pregnant. If they cannot access the abortion pill or need abortion care, the majority have to travel. They have no choice but to travel. People in places like Texas, Florida, Nebraska, Mississippi, those who cannot travel and do not have access to pills are forced to continue with their pregnancies. Here is Planned Parenthood Central State's Chief Medical Officer, Sarah Traxler, speaking to KARE-TV. In this clip, you will also hear from Vice President Kamala Harris and Donald Trump.
We invested in our border communities where abortion remains legal. We expanded our capacity at health centers in Mankato and Minneapolis, as well as in Omaha, where we are tripling our patient capacity by increasing our exam rooms from 4 to 16.
The new Iowa law is also playing into presidential politics.
And this ban is going to take effect before many women even know they're pregnant. And what this means is that 1 in 3 women of reproductive age in America lives in a state with a Trump abortion ban.
Our position is that abortion is now back to the states.
Many in the media are running with Donald Trump's claim that he will leave abortion to the states rather than sign a national abortion ban. Donald Trump appointed 3 justices to the Supreme Court who overturned Roe. Here he is bragging about overturning Roe during a Fox town hall.
Because for 54 years, they were trying to get Roe v. Wade terminated, and I did it, and I'm proud to have done it. They wanted to get it back, right? You wouldn't have that. There would be no question. Nobody else was going to get that done but me.
Yeah.
And we did it, and we did something that was a miracle.
41 states now have abortion bans in effect, with limited exceptions, including 14 with total bans, according to the Guttmacher Institute. If all 50 states were Republican-controlled, we would have close to a national ban. It's important to note that when abortion actually is on the ballot and it goes to the people, they vote for abortion rights. Joining us to talk about the state of abortion across the country are 3 guests. Amy Littlefield is abortion access correspondent for The Nation and author of the forthcoming book, American Crusaders, the story of the anti-abortion movement over the last 50 years and the lessons to be drawn from its ascendance. Hi, Amy. Thank you for joining us again.
Hi, Rose. It's great to be back.
Great to have you. Lori Bertram Roberts is co-director of the Mississippi Reproductive Freedom Fund, an organization that believes in access to full reproductive health care that includes abortion as a human right and an essential part of reproductive justice. Hi, Lori. Thank you for joining us again.
I'm so glad to be back, Rose.
Great to have you. Dr. Regina David Moss is president and CEO of In Our Own Voice, National Black Women's Reproductive Justice Agenda, a national state partnership focused on lifting up the voices of Black women leaders in their fight to secure reproductive justice for all women, girls, and gender expansive individuals. And we are so happy to have Dr. Regina Davis Moss with us. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have all of you. I want to ask you all about this 41 number, because this morning I wrote to the Guttmacher Institute, and I just wanted to confirm the number of states that have banned or restricted abortion. And their press person wrote me back and said, it's really important to talk about what you classify as restricted, because if you look at bans with limited exceptions, before and after Roe was overturned, the number is actually 41. Amy, let's start off with you. This is a number that I never see reported in the media.
Right. And Rose, I also want to make the point, you know, because I just got off a press call with a group of providers and activists who are calling for a much more expansive vision of abortion justice, who are calling for a framework beyond Roe v. Wade. I think it's important to note that, you know, a lot of those restrictions, there are plenty of restrictions, including, you know, 20-week gestational bans, waiting periods that were in place in many of these states before Roe v. Wade fell, right?
Right.
But of course, especially across the South, these restrictions really compound and become, you know, layered on top of each other. I mean, when you look at the fact, for example, that Georgia has a 6-week ban, and Florida has a 6-week ban, and then you have states, of course, across the Deep South that have total bans, like Mississippi, where Lori is. So when patients from those states are looking at their options, you know, they're weighing a state that might, like North Carolina, that has a 72-hour waiting period, where they'd have to go and stay for, you know, several days. It might be the closest option for someone from a state like Florida if they're beyond 6 weeks. But logistically, it's very complicated because, of course, North Carolina is one of those that has restrictions that are not a total ban, but they can, in practice, wind up serving as a de facto ban for many, many people.
And to go back to the 41 number, I think this is really important because in many ways, the pro-abortion, pro-choice movement, and a lot of people argue this, really lost the argument when it came to, is it 6 weeks? Is it 18 weeks? And when you're talking about gestational duration, I'm reading from the Guttmacher Institute, an estimate of the length of time a person has been pregnant. This is typically defined as the number of weeks since the person's last menstrual period, though some states define it as the number of weeks since conception. Lori, this is something that a lot of people don't want to talk about. And according to Guttmacher, you've got 27 states with bans based on gestational duration, 8 at or before 18 weeks, 19 at some point after 18 weeks. And it's like we rarely talk about this now. I mean, Trump is out there saying that you can kill the baby at 9 months or after the baby's born. I mean, ridiculous statements. This is such an important stat that the CDC says abortions after 21 weeks make up about 1% of abortion. That 1% still represents a significant group of people that desperately need access to care. And for many, many reasons this happens. We've heard about these fetal abnormalities. So can you talk about this, Lori? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think first of all, we just need to establish that a ban is a ban. It doesn't matter if it's a gestational ban. It doesn't matter if it's a trap law that's targeted restrictions on abortion providers. It doesn't matter if it's later gestation or earlier gestational limits. Like, a ban is a ban, and all bans are harmful. So I just wanted to put that out there first. The second thing is that when you're talking about putting these gestational limits, like 6 weeks so low, like so soon when most people don't even know they're pregnant, they really are winding up with the exact thing that they say they don't want, which is more people having later abortions. But because of restrictions, a lot of people end up having later abortions now because it's so hard to access care. Right. You might know you want to have an abortion at 7 weeks and not be able to access it until you're 16 weeks.
Right. And then depending on where you live, you might not be able to do that because of these laws. And according to reports, people are now having to travel, if they're able to do that, even further out of state. Regina, what would you add? How do you think we should talk about this, given that what Lori said is a ban is a ban? And if you look at any type of restriction across the country, I'm guessing a lot of people do not know that we're talking about 41 states.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a couple of things I want to lift up. Number one, that these bans, you know, this is a restriction on access to abortion care, but we're not talking about the other restrictions that also have an impact, right? So do I have economic means? Do I have, access to transportation? So there's all these other things. And then if, you know, we do continue, that person needs access to care, you know, a lot of these doctors are leaving these places where there's restrictions. So that's creating these deserts, reproductive care deserts, and where people can't access care. I'm having these conversations all the time about the states where there's restrictions, but, you know, we've done polling in states where there actually is still access. One in particular was California. And one of the things that was lifted up is that even in states where there is access, there's people's sense of safety and security is being threatened. You know, there's, you know, we talked to more than, we talked to 18 to 29-year-olds respondents, and more than half of them say the bans have them thinking about staying in a state that allows abortions. But even then, they've talked to, they know less, 30% of people of their friends who have needed an abortion and weren't able to get it, and cost is a major barrier. So, I mean, there's so many nuances to this. Of course, I'm focusing on Black women, girls, and gender expansive people, and the impact of Dobbs is even more compounded and even more staggering.
Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I mean, we actually asked this question, and two-thirds of Black women of reproductive age that reside in banned states have said that it's made them think about their own risk of mortality if they get pregnant. You know, we got in the background a continuing Black maternal mortality rate that doesn't show any chance of turning around anytime soon. And I always like to say that those deaths are absolutely preventable, but that's a whole nother conversation. Those respondents said they have thought about moving out of state, but we have to ask the question. I mean, people live where they can afford to live. You know, there's an assumption of luxury that we can just move out of state. They thought about not having kids anymore or not expanding their families. They've thought about the risk of being arrested related to pregnancy. You know, if I have a miscarriage, you know, they've seen what has happened in states like Ohio. And overall, they're feeling less safe, which is a terrible, inhumane way to treat people. Pregnancy is supposed to be a time of joy. And it has just created a lot of disarray and chaos in this moment.
Lori, can you talk about what is happening in Mississippi? I feel like before Roe, Mississippi got a lot of media attention at the national level because all of the bans that were put in place before Roe was overturned. But I'm having a hard time finding updates on what has happened in Mississippi after Roe was overturned and the only clinic that offered abortions in Mississippi shut down. So can you give us a sense of what has happened in Mississippi since that clinic shut down?
Yeah, well, Mississippi is in the middle of an abortion care desert. We're in a maternal care desert. We have a problem with having doctors in any capacity in parts of our state. Like there's, I forget the number of counties, but many of our counties have no OBGYNs, no OBGYNs that take Medicaid. But I think the other thing for people to understand is it wasn't just that we lost our clinic in Jackson. It's we lost all the clinics in Louisiana. We lost all the clinics in Alabama. We lost all the clinics in Tennessee. And now Florida has a 6-week ban. So there's nowhere that's nearby for people to go. People are having to go to Illinois, Boulder, D.C., North Carolina, you know what I'm saying, New York. And these are huge, unattainable distances for a lot of people. And the other thing is that I want to piggyback on what Regina was saying, is that it's not just whether or not you can access an abortion in your state, but sometimes it's whether or not you can even leave. If you're undocumented, if you happen to be on probation or parole, there are a number of states that you're not going to be able to maneuver easily through or out of, or even be allowed to leave if you're on probation and parole.
And what are you hearing from people, Lori, about their what resources they have? Because we know that medication abortion is now used in 60% of abortions in the United States. So are you hearing from people in Mississippi who do have easy access to this medication? Just because this came as a surprise to a lot of people, I think, that medications are used in 60% of abortions. But then you do have people who actually need care in a clinic. So what are you hearing from patients?
Yeah, you know, a lot of folks choose to self-manage their abortion, and we don't have hard numbers on that because it's something that's private, and obviously it's legally dubious depending on where you're at. Like, you could have a legal risk to engaging in self-managed abortion, but it is much easier for folks to get pills, and people are getting them. People have been getting them for a long time. Like, this isn't new. That's one of the things about Mississippi, is it wasn't new for folks to start self-managing their abortions in Mississippi. They've been doing it. What's changed is how they were doing it. Before, it was a lot of folks trying herbs or turpentine or bleach or, you know, these like really scary ways, I won't say the herbal is scary, but the other ones are really scary ways of terminating a pregnancy. And now folks have options to get pills.
Another question about Mississippi. Back in March, there was that story that got national attention about the 13-year-old rape victim in Mississippi who had a baby amid a lot of confusion over the state's abortion ban. I mean, it's a horrific story. And Lori, something we talk about a lot on the show when we do shows about abortion is that we are hearing about all of the women who want to become moms and they have a fetal anomaly. And because they live in a state like, say, Mississippi or Texas, they cannot get the care they need, and they're bravely sharing their stories. But what we're not hearing about are the women, girls, and people who can be pregnant who are being forced to carry a baby to term because they do not have access to the pills, or there's confusion, or what have you. And it's hard to find data around that.
Yeah, it is hard to find data because the Turnaway study is the biggest study I can think of people who were turned away from care, but that predates the end of the fall of Roe. But what was found is pretty substantial, is that, you know, if people didn't get the abortion that they wanted or needed, they often fell deeper into poverty, were trapped in relationships, you know, had to postpone education. So there's huge consequences to folks not being able to get the care that they need to get when they need to get it and how they need to get it. I know that I was a turnaway patient in the 90s. So turnaway patients aren't new. It's just that there's more of them, more folks who can't get the care that they want or need and that have to stay pregnant. And most of those people who stay pregnant are going to choose to parent. But what is that parenting journey going to look like, and how traumatic will it be, is the real question.
Amy, what would you add on that? Is there any way to know at this point how many people are being forced to give birth?
I mean, there have been limited studies that show, for example, increased birth rates in states like Texas, right, that were among the first to really severely restrict and ban abortion. I think it's hard to measure, but I think Lori is right that by far the most comprehensive data we have so far is the Turnaway study. And one element that stands out to me from that study is, you know, the impact on folks who are trying to leave abusive relationships, you know, who end up getting trapped, bearing a pregnancy that is a result of sexual assault or, you know, an abusive relationship that they're in. And Rose, I also just wanted to add something on the 6-week ban point, if that's okay, which is, you know, with Iowa just becoming a latest state with a 6-week ban, a lot of people hear 6-week ban and they think that sounds like middle of the road. That sounds reasonable. You know, that sounds like something short of a total ban. And I was recently in Florida, another state with a 6-week ban, and I witnessed this sort of heartbreaking sorting process happening in the waiting room of one of the clinics there, where people would be called in for an ultrasound and be told, you know, if they were 6 weeks and 1 day, they're too far along. If they're 5 weeks and 4 days or 5 weeks and 5 days, there's this really horrible trend that's emerging for people who are at that point, right on the verge of 6 weeks. And I'm hearing about this from a lot of advocates and doctors in Florida, which is folks will find out that they are, you know, 5 weeks and 4 days, because Florida has a 24-hour waiting period. They have to make their decision, get counseling, and then return to the clinic the next day. And oftentimes they don't know. They've just found out they're pregnant, because 5 weeks, again, we're dating from the first day of someone's last menstrual period. You're barely pregnant in 5 weeks, right? You're barely testing positive. And so somebody who is newly understanding that they're pregnant, newly being told that the clock is really ticking, you've got, you know, 24, 48 hours to make this decision. A lot of people are rushing to make the decision because they don't want to lose the opportunity, because for them, it's out of reach as it is for many, if not most Americans, to travel out of state. They are, you know, and maybe they, for whatever reason, they don't know about or don't want to seek, you know, abortion pills from a website like PlanCPills.org. Those folks are rapidly making that decision to get an abortion, and they are oftentimes regretting it or suffering it from, you know, having to kind of cope with and think through their decision after the fact because they didn't have time to do it. And I'm hearing about this over and over again from advocates in states that have these 6-week bans in effect. And I just, you know, I want people to imagine that when we hear messaging that suggests that 6-week bans were somehow, you know, moderate or a compromise, because they've really created this whole new category of agony and torture for pregnant people.
Hmm. Regina, given what you just heard from Amy and Lori, what would you like to add, you know, given what you hear from providers and clinic workers and your national state partnership?
Yeah, I mean, there's the waiting periods, you know, if you're lucky, you're getting in within that time. But I mean, there's also some doctors that don't even want to see patients that early, right? Because there's a chance of them not being a viable pregnancy. But I want to go back to this notion of like being forced and being turned away. I mean, this is why reproductive justice is so important, because what we're really saying is that if we have this conversation and we start with the pregnancy, then we're missing the whole other conversation that needs to happen. So the panelists have talked about questions about, you know, do I have a job? Can I keep, you know, can I stay in school? Do I have a partner that's not going to be upset? You know, do I have to worry about my health? Do I have a chronic illness? And so whether or not the questions we answer, the answers to those questions are going to make a difference on whether or not that unintended pregnancy continues or if it needs to not. And so, you know, what we are always saying is like, we need to stop focusing on that one moment in time and look and go a little bit larger and look at those other social, economic, and political conditions that exist. And that is, you know, the conversation we need to have, because if you're going to force people to continue pregnancies, then we also need the support around them. Mm. So when we're talking about reproductive justice, we're talking about a three-way struggle. We're not just talking about preventing pregnancy. We're not just talking about abortion, we're talking about contraception, and we're talking about the right to live the way we choose.
Right. It's such an important point, Regina. We can also add sex ed to this conversation.
Absolutely.
Like, what information do people have when they're in school?
Right.
Where do they get information? And can you elaborate on this, Regina? Because I feel like at the national level, because of the upcoming election, in major media outlets, and I don't want to paint a broad brush at all, but it almost seems like what you're bringing up is really not getting much attention, because there's so much focus on whether Trump would sign a national ban, and he keeps talking about how he'll leave it to the states, and then the media repeat that. So the issues that you're talking about are really not getting the attention they deserve.
I would say I love the point you made about the comprehensive sex ed. If you look at where the abortion restrictions are happening and you look at the curriculum and how they're trying to make restrictions on comprehensive sex ed, it is no coincidence. So, you know, this is a coordinated effort to continue to have an infringe upon our reproductive freedoms. But with regard to the conversations we're having, so as I said, we are polling people. You know, we know that Black voters are 6 times more likely to vote for candidates who support abortion access. But it's important to underscore that all of that is undergirded by economics. Those are the pressing issues, right? We've already talked about those things, you know, I mean, so cost of living. These are things that have a direct impact on your reproductive decision making. And so we've been having those conversations about why this it's absolutely important to have legal protections, but we need to make sure this conversation is expanded broader to that, because this is a moment in time, but these issues are going to impact us beyond 2024.
Right. We're going to take a quick break. That is Dr. Regina Davis Moss, president and CEO of In Our Own Voice, National Black Women's Reproductive Justice Agenda. Lori Bertram Roberts is co-director of the Mississippi Reproductive Freedom Fund. Amy Littlefield is abortion access correspondent for The Nation. This is Your Call. If you'd like to join today's conversation about the state of abortion across the country before and after Roe, and then all of the other issues that are connected to it, whether it's sex ed or ensuring that families have the resources that they need. It's just such an important point. If politicians, mostly, if not all Republicans, are going to implement forced birth policies, what about access to basic health care, healthy food, education. There's just so much involved in this. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will continue our series on Project 2025 by focusing on immigration. Project 2025 targets immigrants and anyone who looks like one, according to America's Voice. It would do a lot of things, including paving the way for mass family separation, allowing immigration raids on schools, hospitals, and religious institutions, and attacking legal immigration. We hope you can join us for that discussion tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we'll talk about the state of the Democratic Party and its future. A number of potential vice presidential picks, like Governor Tim Walz, are proudly defending progressive policies. So is this still the Clinton Party, or are things changing? We hope you can join us on Thursday. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall at kalw.org. If you'd like to join today's conversation about abortion in the United States, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Dr. Regina Davis-Moss, President and CEO of In Our Own Voice, National Black Women's Reproductive Justice Agenda. Lori Bertram Roberts is co-director of the Mississippi Reproductive Freedom Fund. Amy Littlefield is abortion access correspondent for The Nation and author of the forthcoming book, American Crusaders, the story of the anti-abortion movement over the last 50 years. Amy, can you also elaborate on some of the issues Regina brought up earlier about how this conversation really needs to be expanded? I was just looking at a Fortune article from February. 14 Republican states rejected $40 a month for poor families from the federal government. We can go on and on about Medicaid, free school lunches. I mean, there's just so much there. And yet this is also, I think, a connection that needs to be made more in major media about The Republicans who are passing these extreme bans then turn around and ensure that social services are not provided.
You know, I'm so glad you raised that, and Regina raised that as well, Rose. I mean, this is really the absolutely irreconcilable, glaring contradiction that has been at the heart of the Republican project over the last 40 plus years, you know, really since the administration of Ronald Reagan, right? Which is this idea that, you know, we're pro-life, we're banning abortion, we're saving unborn children. And at the very same time, we are, you know, cutting the legs out from under any policy that could potentially help working class and low-income families to survive. And that has gone largely unchallenged, at least to the extent that it should, you know, for many decades, right? They've been able to get away with pulling this ridiculous fast one, right, where they claim to be pro-family and yet oppose, you know, welfare and programs that would support working people and allow them to survive, especially when it comes to, you know, healthcare options sought by women. And I really think that this is the moment for Democrats to articulate a full-throated reproductive justice agenda that encompasses not just the right to abortion, right, which is the big hot topic in this election, but that melds together the issue of abortion and reaches the majority of voters that are pro-choice with a message that is also about, hey, you know, every family that I know out there of a kid under five is absolutely buried under figuring out how they're going to access childcare. Okay, so let's talk about the cost of childcare. Let's talk about the fact that I know parents going back to work after, you know, a couple weeks, right? Because we don't have paid parental leave in this country. Let's talk about health insurance, you know? And I really think it's cynical and it's scary in this moment we saw coming out of the Republican National Convention that Republicans are really trying to make a play for being the party of the working man, right? I mean, we saw the Teamsters president addressing the Republican National Convention. We see J.D. Vance coming out with a sort of pseudo-leftist, you know, working class rhetoric to advance what is really a pretty authoritarian agenda. And so I think this is really a moment for Democrats to set up a platform that doesn't just say, look, we're the party that's going to restore Roe, or we're the party that's pro-choice, but it says we're the party that not only doesn't want to ban abortion, but we want to support all of the different, you know, economic aspects that people, especially women who bore the brunt of, you know, COVID and having to take care of families in that moment, that those families need to survive. I mean, now is really the moment, and I'll be listening to the Democratic National Convention to see how Kamala Harris is able, who supports many of these policies, you know, is able to sort of meld a message of economic justice and abortion together, rather than treating abortion as a separate issue. Because, of course, for families who are making decisions about how many kids to have, it's not separate. It's part and parcel. It's a kitchen table issue.
Well, this is also an important issue because we know that President Biden was not very comfortable talking about abortion. He rarely used the word. And something that struck me about what Vice President Kamala Harris has been saying on the campaign trail is that the majority of Black women and girls live in the South. And with the exception of one state, abortion is banned in the South. Lori, I think this is just such an important point to make. Can you talk more about that? And also, just to add to that, given that, according to data, 1 in 3 Mississippi kids lives in poverty, have the Republicans that control the state done anything to actually help these families?
No. The thing that we have to be really honest about is that there's a reason why they don't want these programs, right? It's not just that they're like, oh, poor people shouldn't have this X, Y, and Z, but at the crux of places like the Heritage Foundation, which wrote Project 2025, they want to return quote unquote charity to churches. Okay. So they want you to have to go through the church to get assistance. They want a domestic supply of infants. That's what was written in Dobbs, right? That we have a domestic supply of infants issue. Well, if you give people money to be able to parent, they're not as likely to choose adoption. And so there's like nefarious levels of strategy going on to make people make decisions, to make decisions for people, including forcing them to parent, but then also taking their children.
Can you give us a sense of, because, you know, Lori, I mean, the fact of the matter is people always use Mississippi as an example of, you know, the worst in poverty, the worst in education and healthcare, without providing the much needed context about why that's the case. So can you talk more about that? I mean, what is the state of, you know, families in Mississippi who are living in poverty, or people who are being forced to have children that they cannot afford?
Yeah, Mississippi is, you know, one of the poorest states in the nation. A lot of people know about the big TANF scandal, TANF money. There's $72 million of TANF money that went missing that hasn't been accounted for yet, that families and children would have loved to have had but never got to have. But instead, there is a sparkling new volleyball stadium at Southern Miss University. The state for folks in Mississippi is dire because it's levels, like, again, it's levels of things. It's not being able to get assistance. It's no paid leave. It's not being able to afford childcare. It's not being able to afford diapers. It's not being able to have a car to get your kids places if you live in a rural area. It's all of these things. And the Republican Party has done nothing except for, I will give them one thing, they did expand postpartum Medicaid to a year, but that doesn't help with all the other things that people need assistance with to have healthy, happy families and to make real decisions without being their decisions being made for them.
How are you connecting with these families, Lori? Now that abortion is fully banned and there are no clinics in Mississippi that offer reproductive health care.
Yeah, so we partner with a clinic in the Delta called Plan A Healthcare. We have our own free pantry. We have a diaper closet. We have a period supply closet. So we're doing work in the community beyond abortion. We always have, because we're a reproductive justice organization, not simply an abortion fund. And so that's how we're coming into contact with folks. Like, you, if you talk to people long enough, you'll hear a story. If you sit down and really sit at people's tables with them or on their front porches, you're going to hear stories of so-and-so they knew wanted to have an abortion but couldn't have one, and now they're struggling. Or just folks we know that are struggling who have called us and said, you know, Miss Lori, I can't go out of state. It's too late for me. Now I have to have a baby.
Wow.
Those people find us. We don't really have to find anyone.
It's devastating, Regina, to think that women, girls, people who can get pregnant are out there right now having children that they could not afford or did not want for whatever reason, and don't have the help that they desperately need.
Yeah, I mean, when you ask people, the common response is just, it was not something I could do at this time, or it was just too much at this time. And, you know, we just really need to appreciate that, you know, this requires all these supports around this. I mean, and, you know, people always want to talk about the moral issue, you know, and I try to say, if you can't understand it from a moral point, like, let's make the business case, right? We want to be the most competitive country. We want to make sure we're racing against the other ones in terms of productivity. Well, when you have all of these things happening, when people can't take time, when have to, you know, take time off of work, or they're not their best health, or all of these things, like, that has an impact on how we are as a country, right? And the face of the country is changing colors, right? And so if you are leaving whole populations, Black and brown, my AAPI sisters, behind, that will have an impact on us. These are the people that are responsible for the goods and services of our country. We're not dispensable.
And now that it has been 2 years since Roe was overturned, we know that the Republican Party has been wanting this for decades. We just heard about what has not been happening in Mississippi. Regina, what about other states? Have there been any efforts to increase access to a variety of social services?
I mean, the majority of the community that I'm most lifting up and advocating for of childbearing age are in the South. And so they are continuing to have all of their reproductive freedoms taken away. Not to mention voting rights and all these other things that are two sides of the same coin, right? How do we get people in office to pass the policies that we need so that we can thrive? If you want to take away our rights to vote. So, I mean, I am talking to folks day to day about how these issues impact them. But at the same time, Black women, I have to say it, are the largest voting bloc in the American electorate. We're some of the most decisive voters. And we know the power of our vote. We know we have the capacity to make change. And so we're out here educating folks to understand that while we've heard it before, that these elections are important, this year it's particularly important.
Dr. Regina Davis Moss is president and CEO of In Our Own Voice, National Black Women's Reproductive Justice Agenda. Lori Bertram Roberts is co-director of the Mississippi Reproductive Freedom Fund. Amy Littlefield is abortion access correspondent for The Nation and author of the forthcoming book, American Crusaders, the story of the anti-abortion movement over the last 50 years. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Amy, I remember when Roe was first overturned, I would hear anti-abortion activists be asked the question about whether they support healthcare for all, or, well, they weren't actually, I didn't hear them ask that pointed question, but just, do you support expanded social services? And they would say, we're working on that. And I thought, well, it's been decades. Where's the plan? Have you been able to ask any, given your upcoming book, have you been able to ask pointed questions to anti-abortion activists about why there are so few social services for people who need them?
Right, exactly. I mean, and it's because of that, you know, alliance that happened beginning in the late 1970s, early 1980s, where the anti-abortion movement decided to throw its support behind the Republican Party. It decided the Republican Party was going to be its vehicle for achieving its anti-abortion goals, right? And the Republican Party at that time was not interested in expanding the social safety net. They were interested in privatization and in doing everything possible to, you know, reverse any semblance of a welfare state in the United States. And so, so it's interesting because you'll find different takes on that depending on who you talk to, right? There are certainly activists within the anti-abortion movement who believe that the movement and the Republican Party need to do better. At, you know, expanding social services. And then there are politicians who will, of course, pay lip service to the idea, oh, we really need to come up with, you know, a plan and a way to support these families if they're being forced into pregnancy. Well, but then when you look at their record, you know, what have they actually done in practice? And it's often been, you know, taking away the very basic services that people need in order to survive. And so I think it's an interesting moment of reckoning right now, actually, for the anti-abortion movement to sort of reflect on that alliance with the Republican Party. Because one of the things that I think is really disappointing to the anti-abortion movement, but is a testament to groups like Lori's, is that the abortion rate in this country has not dropped as a result of the Dobbs decision by nearly the amount that the anti-abortion movement hoped and expected that it would, right? And that's because abortion funds like Lori's, based in states in the South and across the country, are moving mountains to help people get the health care that they need, right? I mean, these are groups that are shelling out thousands of dollars to help people fly out of state or to pay for their procedures. And, you know, so I'm looking at a study, Rose, because you asked about measuring sort of the impact of the Dobbs decision. There was one study that came out last year that found birth rates are up in states with abortion bans. These particular researchers measured about 30,000 additional births on an annual basis as a result of abortion bans, which would be a 2.3% increase. I mean, it's sort of hard to wrap your head around like how big that number is, right? If you're somebody who doesn't believe people should be forced into pregnancy, that's a staggering number to comprehend because every single one of those is an individual whose life has been changed immeasurably, right? If you're somebody who opposes abortion and is trying to bring the number of abortions in the country to zero, then that number, you know, is unacceptably low because you want, you know, you want to stamp it out entirely. And frankly, I think anti-abortion activists are frustrated at the permeability of their abortion bans. That's why we're seeing these ideas like abortion-related travel bans, you know, coming up from people in high places. And so, you know, I think it's a complex question. I think, frankly, there are people within the anti-abortion movement who are true believers who really want to reduce the number of abortions and believe that providing social services is a key part of that. They tend to think that perhaps the vehicle for doing that is through private and religious organizations, such as crisis pregnancy centers that are, you know, offering coercive counseling and trying to steer people towards not getting an abortion. And so I think it is really sort of a moment to look back over the last 50 years and look at that alliance between the political party that wanted to make it harder for working class people to have kids and yet make it impossible to get an abortion and to say, huh, how did that agenda work out for you?
Hmm. Well, and if we can spend the last 5 or so minutes talking about where we go from here and the politics around this. I mean, Republicans have been wildly successful in getting the media to cover abortion as the most divided issue of our time, even though about 70% of the country supports abortion rights. Abortion was not mentioned at the Republican National Convention. I wasn't really surprised by this because when you take it to the people, they almost always vote for reproductive justice. So, Lori, what really strikes you about how major media are covering the Republican Party, Donald Trump, and abortion right now?
I think the thing that's like the most disheartening is how often it's seen as inevitable, okay, not a big deal for these abortion bans to exist. As if, like, there's just this small segment of people who are impacted by that, when there's really huge swaths of people being impacted, and you can't talk about it without talking about the Southeast and what's happening to Black women and girls and gender expansive people down here, where there's the least amount of access, the least amount of resources.
I think this is such an important point, Lori, because I'm also struck when people just casually talk about these bans on the radio. I often think about the girls, Lori, the 13-year-olds, the 15-year-olds. Once in a while, we get this horrific story about a 13-year-old who was forced to carry a child to term and a baby to term. And I remember when this happened, a lot of people didn't know that a 13-year-old could get pregnant, which just speaks to what we don't know about how the body works, right? So, exactly. Lori, what can you tell us about how this is all affecting girls? I just think about that, and just I wish we had more information about that and talked about it more.
Actually, talking about girls actually makes me the most sad, because in many ways they have the least options. You have states trying to enact travel bans for teenagers and girls if they're trying to leave the state to have an abortion. You have all these states that have parental notification and parental permission laws. For younger women, they have additional onerous restrictions on their own health care and their own bodily freedom. And let me just say, the youngest girl we've ever funded was 12. Okay, when my daughters were clinic escorts at the clinic in Jackson, occasionally there would be former classmates of my daughters that were coming in their school uniforms directly from school to get procedures. So we can't make it seem like these girls aren't out here, or they're all just happily pregnant by their classmate, when really a lot of them are pregnant by older, much, much older men, and in situations that they don't necessarily want to be in. If a girl wants to parent, I am here to support her parenting journey, but no one should be forced to be a parent.
We're going to have to do an entire show about that. Thank you for sharing those stories. I really wish we had more time. Regina, we have a couple of minutes left. What about, if Kamala Harris becomes president in November, what could the Democrats do at this point? I guess we have to say, if they got 60 senators who are pro-choice, what could they do at this point at the national level?
Well, I mean, of course, the focus is going to be restoring legality. But I, as a reproductive justice activist, am going to say that Roe was never enough for us. You've probably heard that statement all the time. And so now we have the opportunity to fight for more. I'm very excited about the VP, because she has been consistent in her advocacy and her legislation to advance reproductive justice. I mean, just this week, she announced the Fight for Reproductive Freedom Week of Action. But even before that, I mean, we've talked about how broad the supports need to be. I mean, she has launched maternal health issues. She's extended the tax care credit. I mean, even things like electric school buses and providing funding for that, because that has an impact on our ability to raise children in safe and sustainable environments. Like, we don't want them subjected to things like asthma and lead and all these other things. And so there's a real opportunity here to get what we've always been fighting for. Reproductive justice celebrates 30 years. Actually, today marks the beginning. And so we're excited about it, and we're going to continue to fight for more.
Wow, I did not know that about reproductive justice. 30 years today?
Yes, 30 years today. Those 12 women were at a conference in Chicago that was discussing the Clinton's healthcare reform policy, and they became very frustrated at the singular focus on abortion. So isn't that ironic? And so we're right back here. And so this time we need to get it right.
Wow, amazing. And Amy, we have about a minute or so left. What Regina talks about is what you pointed out earlier, that you just got off a call with abortion rights activists who say people need to think about this in much broader terms.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a group including Dr. Jenny DiVincenzio and Colleen McNicholas and reproductive justice activist Pamela Merritt. And they're saying, they're calling in the movement, saying, listen, a lot of the ballot initiatives, for example, that we're seeing out there in states like Florida, allow states to ban abortion after viability. And they're saying, you know, patients who need abortion later in pregnancy were already, you know, left out under the Roe framework. They tend to be folks who are already marginalized, who face higher rates of maternal mortality. And in this moment where, you know, the reproductive rights and justice movement has no choice but to start from scratch, they're saying, listen, we should be calling for an expansive vision. We should not be compromising. We should be, you know, going for full reproductive freedom that, you know, repeals the Hyde Amendment, the ban on public funding of Medicaid, and that also, you know, doesn't accept restrictions on pregnancy at any gestation. So I think you're seeing a real difference of a strategy difference within the movement, right, about whether to move forward with policies like these ballot initiatives that compromise right from the get-go based on what they think will allow them to pass in states like Florida. And then reproductive justice activists who are saying, listen, Roe was a very highly imperfect framework, and there were people who were forced to remain pregnant even, you know, in those years. And so let's dream about something bigger. And I think that conversation, it'll be interesting to see how that intersects with the way Democrats discuss this issue at the DNC in August.
Well, we will definitely do a show about that. Amy Littlefield is abortion access correspondent for The Nation and author of the forthcoming book, American Crusaders, about the anti-abortion movement. Lori Bertram Roberts is co-director of the Mississippi Reproductive Freedom Fund. And Dr. Regina Davis Moss is president and CEO of In Our Own Voice, National Black Women's Reproductive Justice Agenda. Dr. Davis Moss, Lori, and Amy, thank you for your work, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks,
and
Rose.
You can find a number of articles about what we mentioned today at KALW.org. Click on news and then your call. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering today's show. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.